All right, now it is time for David Terechuk and the Media Beat. David joins us on a Friday morning. We broadcast it over the course of the weekend, also following our 12 new news on Monday. David is a PBS television correspondent, reports on ethics and belief, has his own website, which is themediabeat.us. Good morning, David.
Well, it's good to be with you, reporting in, as usual, from the media capital of the world, New York City.
And just a few minutes ago, the news broke, and that is the death of Prince Philip.
Yes, the Queen's consort. Prince Philip died at 99. he was a dogged kind of presence in the British royal family, and I guess nobody was quite... I mean, nobody was terribly surprised that he lived as long as he did. He did seem to be a sturdy presence with an ability to just keep on plowing. There's a quote from him that is often used by the press who are obliged to or feel obliged to do profiles of him over the years. And that was, we have, let me quote it exactly, the way that it's often reproduced anyway. We have got to make this monarchy thing work, is what he's supposed to have said. No one can quite source when and to whom he said that, but that's very much the attitude that seemed to prevail, to be attributed to him. It's very much the label that suited him as far as the press call was concerned. Anyway, he was always there at the Queen's side. He had no, of course, official authority, but he was a kind of rock-like presence in the Queen's life, and she has certainly been on record, again, unofficially, for saying that he was very much her rock. Along with that was a characterization that was more on the negative side, I suppose, of steadiness. He had a reputation for stubbornness and for an ability to, in a way, sort of be a rock in the ocean in a different sense, in that he would go against a lot of currents. He would not go, he would just sit or stand immovably against certain currents, which is kind of ironic because he's also credited with a desire to do that thing of making the monarchy thing work, as he said. He was said to be responsible for, you know, taking a certain degree of modernization onto the shoulders of the royal family. And what that was one way to ensure that the monarchy would survive in changing times. Along with that stubbornness came a certain kind of prejudice against people that weren't like him. He was renowned, unfortunately, for some distressingly racist comments, sometimes on the record, sometimes off the record. He was a man of his time, I would say, and his time was pretty much the last century. But there he is. He's been working on... he only retired at 95, so he's been a steady presence, and one that we could never ignore, but it was rather hard to actually define, except for its kind of air of immutability, in the sense that here was an institution that was going to carry on and just do what it does. In a way, that was reflected inside the family too. It's no secret. Certain biographers, in particular a biographer I know well, found evidence while writing a biography of his first son, Prince Charles, that he was something of a bully towards that son, while at the same time being indulgent to other members of the family. Amongst his children, he was said to regard Prince Charles as quote-unquote something of a wimp, And I think that had a considerable effect on the young Charles, who's of our generation. He's never quite gotten over being being so labeled by his own father. There we have, I suppose, a snapshot of an individual in a family that, like all families, is complicated, but he had a kind of sturdy, I'm not going to say simple, but easily appreciable kind of stock character that, as I say, dates back so firmly to the last century.
Well, you know, he's married to the Queen for 73 years, and as a matter of fact, her reign as Queen, she began as a very, very young woman. People forget she has just been through when you compare her reign and the Prince being with her, it's absolutely amazing how the world has changed since they first occupied the Queen and the Prince.
Yeah, if we thought Queen Victoria had a long reign, covering a lot of temporal changes in the time that she was on the throne. Queen Elizabeth II has had an extraordinarily long reign, and as you say, covering an awful lot of period of change. And of course, that change has changed the nature of the royal family. I mean, this family was the first one to allow the press, presumably for its own self-survival purposes, as conjured up by that phrase of Prince Philip's, we've got to make the monarchy thing work. But of course, there was a downside to the sort of extraordinary sort of symbiotic relationship that the royal family had with the press corps, particularly the tabloid press corps. And we've seen that working out in very recent times with the Harry and Meghan saga of the interview in particular, the big American interview with Oprah in particular. That relationship between the press and through it the public perception of the royal family was something of a poison chalice. It was felt necessary by the royal court, and at the same time it was bemoaned by the court constantly. And the balance between privacy for members of the family and intrusion on the press corps side was constantly in flux and constantly being argued about, and stubborn spats broke out, and issues of some importance, and other times, completely unimportant issues came out of that. But it was a contentious but necessary, as I say, symbiotic relationship that continued over decades.
Well, it's a story that obviously we'll all hear much about over the course of the next several days and week, as it's covered not only by national news, but international news as well. I want to switch back to something that last week we talked about, and you were absolutely right. I did watch over the course of the past week some snippets. I have not watched the live coverage. I have watched snippets of coverage early in the morning. And coming out of this trial, which is happening with Chauvin, the thing that amazes me in this trial, and I guess maybe I shouldn't expect it, there's a thing called the blue line where, police don't rat on police, they don't tell on police, and that's trying to be broken down all across not only this country but the world. But I am absolutely stunned at the amount of police officials, both ranking officials and officers, that really have been critical of the way the officers handled George Floyd. I mean, it has been almost unanimous where these officers and with these police officials that are a higher ranking have just said it was just plain wrong.
Well, yes, the prosecution has taken a tactical decision here, and you can see the sense of doing that to present police officers themselves in the front rank of witnesses for the prosecution. If you believe as a prosecutor that you're excuse me, if you believe as a prosecutor that the person you're prosecuting is guilty of such a serious crime, then of course you're going to reach for the most authoritative kinds of evidence that you possibly can. And if it's a police officer, then it will, as you say, by being almost counterintuitive and certainly unusual in its presentation, to bring out phalanxes of serving officers and experienced officers and much more senior officers who can reflect on the importance of this breach of normal police conduct as they present it, then of course you're going to buttress your prosecutorial case, and it's a smart thing to do. It would appear from the way that the evidence has been laid out, a perfectly sensible way of conducting this prosecution. The accused is charged with a murder at different counts, or different degrees rather, first down to third degree of murder, of homicide being pursued, and it's it makes total sense from a prosecution's kind of point of view to lay on the nature of the offence, not just as a murder, but as a complete dereliction of a police officer's code of conduct, as laid out time and time again about matters of appropriate use of force, in particular, and saying that it is a that the methods used allegedly by officer or ex-officer, fired officer Chauvin, amount to an abrogation of the training that he'd received as well. So it all makes total sense, and the best that the defense can do at the moment, of course, is to pick on details and suggest that different video angles show that it happened a different way, and of course to keep returning to their core argument that the drugs that the dead man, George Floyd, is supposed to have taken, and we don't know in what quantity, is actually responsible for the cause of death and not the actions of the accused officer.
Another story that we talked about all during the run-up to the vote on Brexit, after Brexit was approved, and that is what might happen in Northern Ireland. And I've been very closely over the past week following what's going on with people being arrested, water cannons for the first time in a long, long time coming out in Belfast. And we talked about what
police also firing rubber bullets for the first time in a long time, too, as the crowds got riotous and violence broke out. Yes, it's for many people, for not you, just you alone, Marshall, but many people experienced in the Northern Ireland story as a whole over the decades. There are coming out in the press coverage stories those phrases, we didn't think this would be happening again, and it's very redolent of the worst times of the troubles. I keep seeing that phrase being used. I'm not sure that it is as serious as that, but it is deeply worrying, and it is also, as you suggested, a very unwelcome coming true of the worst fears that many of us were expressing as the Brexit split between Britain and Europe would inevitably highlight the nature of the Irish border and the complications that it would happen if one part of the island stayed in Europe and another half was taken in the view of many people, unwillingly out of the European Union, and those tensions and conflicts that were set up are now bursting out in very all too familiar ways, very redolent of the 70s and 80s indeed.
And this really all comes about simply because of the restrictions imposed at the border, right?
Simply is probably not the word I would use, but because it is complicated. In essence, from the point of view of the so-called loyalist community of Northern Ireland, the ones who feel themselves so fully tied to the United Kingdom, From their point of view, the border has been shifted from being across the island where they wanted to be to becoming some kind of entity, some invisible line drawn in the North Sea between the island of Ireland and the mainland, as it's called, of the United Kingdom. This is for the convenience of European Union rules, in the loyalists' view, and of course that's given rise to a resurgence of the most important fear that the loyalists, who are overwhelmingly Protestants, of course, feel about their status in the island of Ireland as a whole. They feel if that border across the land border is being more and more softened, and the creation of a new border, notionally at least, but with lots of paperwork involved in crossing it, when goods come across the water from the mainland to the six counties of Northern Ireland, then you are having what they fear most, which is a de facto separation of Northern Ireland from the UK, the very thing that they're so determined to prevent and have been ever since 1921 when their state was declared and that line was drawn across the island because it was what they wanted. So, yes, these are Protestant-led riots in a familiar form, though, of course, the divisions within the Northern Irish community are sparked by it, and you get a response from the nationalist community, the nationalist and predominantly Catholic community, that on the whole favours that land border fading away anyway, and you've got a rich recipe for nightly violence as we've been seeing this week.
It's amazing how when you look at the progression of Brexit, how this has always been on the back burner, and now it is a very very quickly moved to the front burner, and see how it develops. Finally, I just have to talk a little bit about North Korea and ask you about that. I mean, you have obviously COVID is affecting them worse than that they've let out. They've had to shut their borders with Russia, and now once again they fear that the famine that is about to hit North Korea is going to be even far worse than the famine that hit many, 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 many years ago.
Well, that's the cost of running a totalitarian regime, of course. You cut yourself off from the world, and you deliberately don't allow the rest of the world to even know what's going on in there. you inevitably are left with your own resources, your own resources only, to deal with a serious thing like a pandemic, which is becoming demonstrated the world over again and again and again, that no nation can handle it on its own, and that every nation needs to be a collaborative entity in a world community dealing with a world event, and that's not the way that certain other countries besides North Korea take that attitude too, but perhaps North Korea is the most salient example of that, and they're reaping the whirlwind now as a result of that, and doggedly and stubbornly, to go back to that word again about stubbornness, they are not accepting any help from anybody else, and for the moment at least they're not likely to get it, but we'll see how that pans out.
You know, it's interesting to look at those stories of Prince Philip passing away and the Queen's reign, and look at the North Korea. It's almost like you're looking back in time at a time that was 30, 40, 50 years ago, but it's in present time, and it's almost like time has stood still in those instances.
Well, there is the old saying of plus ça change in French. The more things change, the more they look the same, is the full quotation. I guess there are some things that are just perennial parts of our international landscape, and we should not be surprised by seeing the same tropes being demonstrated as time moves on, and the same issues will inevitably surface again and again and again.
And also surfacing again and again and again, I have to put this in, is Senator Joe Manchin. He's going to enjoy his 15 minutes of fame.
Well, if you have a finely balanced, only finely balanced in the sense of political physics, I suppose, on a pivot point in the Senate, you have a 50-50 balance between Republicans and Democrats, then you get a well-established and somewhat truculent Democratic presence like Manchin from West Virginia, then, of course, his moment will have come, and it has come. And he now feels, understandably, I guess, that he can have some influence over the Biden administration overall, and it's a way of approaching the very necessary dramatic, and in you know, Biden's chosen case, very dramatic steps to take hold of the pandemic, and through the exercise of taking hold of the pandemic will in fact create massive changes to the way America handles lots of things, including its infrastructure and all the things that are being argued about as whether they deserve to be included in the big infrastructure spending package that's prepared. And I mentioned trying to hold out for things that he knows are more supported by the Republican side of the aisle, which with which he claims to have an understanding, if not outright sympathy, and make sure that what he calls bipartisanship is maintained. Now, we have an argument developing about the very worth, whether there is any real value left in the idea of bipartisanship in this particular Congress at this particular time. And we'll see how that pans out, too. But I suspect that he's going to try and exact as much much of a political price as he possibly can, and get capital flowing his way if he makes his vote essential to the passage of what the Biden administration wants to get through Congress. And if he manages to do that, then bipartisanship, I guess, of a kind will be the hallmark of some of the legislation that gets passed. But I think a lot of the time from now on, you will see the Biden administration using the casting vote of the Vice President Kamala Harris in the Senate as a way to ram things through that it believes wholeheartedly need to be rammed through for the good of the country in the wake of the pandemic.
As a journalist that has covered the world in general, do you think that Joe Biden is pulling up his weight of the bargain? I think that with everything that's going on between the pandemic, between China and North Korea, between what's going on in Northern Ireland and the UK and Europe as well, I think that the steady presence at the top is really important to us here at the United States in our interactions with the rest of the world.
Well, you'll find most international journalists are not exactly heaving a huge sigh of relief still since January the 20th, but there's certainly a sense that we can tell, seasoned observers can certainly sense that you have a firm pair of hands at the tiller at the moment. Now, there are some situations which require fast and instant action. The oldest president we've had is now actually moving very nimbly and taking some very big decisions very quickly. But that's not to say they haven't been thought about long and hard over the campaign period and over the gestation period of the new Biden approach. And we're seeing something that smacks of, dare I say, firm government. And for many people, that's more than welcome after 4 years of chaos and insanity. That's the way it's being regarded. And I think the rest of what's certainly true, as you talk to overseas diplomats who are charged with monitoring America's behavior in the world arena, I think everyone, with the possible exception of Chairmen Putin and Xi in Russia and China, respectively, are finding it a very welcome change.
Well, David, we'll speak to you next week. Have a great weekend, and we'll see what develops in Northern Ireland and what the pandemic and more over the course of the next week.
I look forward to speaking to you next week.
All right, take care, David. That is The Media Beat with David Taraschuk. Once again, his media website is themediabeat.us. You can also find The Media Beat at robinhoodradio.com. Click on demand. Click on The Media Beat with David Taraschuk.